This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 305 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and we'll get things going by introducing the co-hosts. First, we have David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation guy. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Hello, listeners. Greetings from warm Philadelphia. Summer has arrived, and this recording in daylight is just night. It just does not work for me.
Yeah, I know how you feel. Also with us is Rob Mark, journalist, writer for the Jetwine blog, and a lot of other things. Rob, how are you?
Well, I hope nobody heard the thunder here, but we're having a bit of a thunderstorm rain here in Chicago tonight. So if it gets a little loud, a little punky, it's not me with the sound effects. It's actually thunderstorms.
All right. And if we lose you altogether, we'll know that the power in Chicago is out.
Yes, I'll just put Simba on the spinning wheel to generate the current.
Yeah, there we go. Also with us is Max Trescott. Now, Rob, what's Max Trescott doing here?
Max is here because I invited him. And the reason I invited him is that I have a little announcement to make for all of our listeners. I was just listening to episode 305, and I think David and I have been around since what? Episode what, David? Maybe 45 or something, or 50,
yeah,
somewhere in there. Yeah. But I'm going to be taking a little leave of absence over the summer. I have a contract to write a book, and I need to finish this book. And so every spare moment is extremely precious to me. And I'm not disappearing forever. I'm just taking a little rest, at least with my voice, but certainly not with my fingertips and keyboard. So I should be back, hopefully, around Labor Day, but I'll be popping in and out when you guys least expect it, kind of like Dan used to do when he first went away,
okay.
But except I'm coming back. So Max is our guest. He's going to be my stand-in. He'll be, well, he can't, I don't think you can be Rob, can you, Max?
Well, I think I'm probably like Conan, you know, when he would guest host, except he never got to keep the show. They threw him out afterwards.
That's right.
Oh, well, that's not going to happen here.
Exactly.
Well, it's great to have Max T with us. Max is a CFI. He's an author, a speaker, sort of generally an advocate for GA, and of course, a past Airplane Geeks host, not host, guest, I guess. So Max T, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks very much. It's nice to be on this side of the studio, so I'm looking forward to spending a number of sessions with you here this summer.
Can I just give one more accolade to Mr. Trescott, because he is also a national certified flight instructor of the year winner, which is someone that the FAA picks every year as the top dog in flight instruction. So Max is one of those guys.
Yeah, he is, absolutely. Plus, he's a really nice guy, if you've ever met him.
And wait a minute, I know where this is going, and what? I'm not? Is that where this was going?
Now, and folks, just so you know, to confuse you even more, we now have Max Takeoff and Max Flight. So you guys have to figure out who needs to be who.
All right. Well, listen, we better introduce our guest for this episode before we go on too long. That's Steve Zonka. Now, Steve is a longtime commercial aviation professional with airline and aviation OEM experience, but he's also the executive director of the Commercial Aviation Alternative Fuels Initiative. Steve, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks, Max. I appreciate it.
Now, the Commercial Aviation Alternative Fuels Initiative, CAAFI, do you call that CAFI?
We do call it CAFI, yes.
Oh, good, because it's such a mouthful otherwise.
Yes.
Now, we're going to have a a good conversation in more detail coming up. But just quickly, give us an idea. Who are the members of CAFI? Who belongs to this organization?
Well, we actually have about 800 members affiliated with CAFI. We're a public-private partnership, and we're sponsored by FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, Airlines for America, the industry advocacy group, the Aerospace Industries Association, comprised of all of the manufacturers of aviation products, and Airports Council International. So they're our direct sponsors. And then amongst our 800 members, they're spread out across the world and from nearly every discipline associated with aviation.
You know, I think that's really impressive from the standpoint of including all of the, well, the stakeholders in this whole area of alternative fuels and alternative jet fuels and so forth. So it's really great to hear that everyone seems to be working together on this topic. And we're going to talk a lot about that coming up. First, though, we've got a little bit of aviation news from the past week. We're going to focus on the NTSB's report on the crash of Asiana Flight 214. And if we have time, we'll touch on some other items. Also coming up, David, the history segment, what are we looking at this episode?
We're looking at pretty obscure jet trainer / very light jet transport, which is the Saab 105.
All right, great. We also have an Australia desk coming up and Across the Pond segment. And let's see, Rob, do we have an aviation minute this time?
No, unfortunately, I'm sorry. This week, we're going to be aviation minute free. And that's because we kind of had to go to a biweekly production schedule because of this whole book commitment thing. But so you guys will be able to hear me sort of recorded at least.
Okay, so even though you're going to be working on other things this summer, you'll still be sending us some aviation minutes?
Absolutely. David said he's going to be handling all of that for me because he has nothing else to do with his free time.
Okay.
Yeah, like, you know, the best thing about Rob on Memorex, you can pull out the tape and destroy it.
For the new segment, we'd like to concentrate on the NTSB report concerning the crash of Asiana Flight 214. And just to make sure everyone is fully aware of this, you'll recall that on July 6th last year, 2013, Asiana Flight 214 crashed on approach at San Francisco International Airport. This was the plane that struck the seawall at the end of the runway. Of the 291 passengers, three died. 40 passengers, eight of the 12 flight attendants, and one of the four flight crew members received serious injuries, and the rest received minor injuries or were not injured. We have a summary from the NTSB, and we'll have links in the show notes to that. Which, by the way, if you haven't read an NTSB report yet, they're very readable. But to summarize it, the NTSB says, quote, "The NTSB determined that the flight crew mismanaged the initial approach and that the airplane was well above the desired glide path as it neared the runway. In response to the excessive altitude, the captain selected an inappropriate autopilot mode and took other actions that, unbeknownst to him, resulted in the auto throttle no longer controlling airspeed." So, Rob, you're probably following this pretty closely. And it kind of comes around in part to this autopilot and how that works on the 777. Do you think that, this is a pilot issue as the NTSB is pointing to?
Well, I did sit in on the 3-hour NTSB hearing last Tuesday, and it was very interesting, actually. And I would tell any of our listeners that, as you said, have not read a report, to go up to ntsb.gov, and there is a video recording of the entire session, and you'll see the animations that were used. In fact, one of the lead specialists handling the explanation of what happened to 214 was our buddy Bill English, that we just ran into a couple of weeks ago there at the NTSB Training Center when we were out there. And so I think he did a really good job of not getting into a lot of technical babble. But essentially what they found was that the pilot flying, the left seat pilot, who was not inexperienced, thought the auto throttles were going to do something that they did not do. And the pilot in the right seat, the pilot monitoring, who also happened to be essentially acting as the line instructor for this pilot, did not pay attention enough to, unfortunately, save the airplane either. And so at the point they finally decided they were too low, it was just 5 or 6 seconds before the airplane hit. And so the NTSB found basically against the pilots, although there were extenuating circumstances as far as they were concerned, that some of the language that explained how the auto throttles worked in the Boeing manuals was not as clear as it should have been. So they had a number of recommendations, some against Boeing, some to the FAA, some to Asiana Airlines, some to the city of San Francisco, some to the fire and rescue people at San Francisco International Airport. So it was, they tried to spread it all around.
Hey, Rob, I have a question for you. Manuals. In this case, it was Asiana. Do manuals get translated, or are they always written in English because technically English is the language of aviation? And who's responsible for translating these the Boeing manuals into whatever the native language is, if it does happen?
Well, now, that's a very interesting question, David. I know the Boeing people, most likely under some sort of a contract with Asiana, did do some of the training on the 777, but I don't know the answer to the question on that. But you know what? I'm going to, as we're kind of standing here, I'm going to quick email one of our contacts there at the NTSB and see if he might be able to answer that question for us before the end of the show. But I think that's a really interesting one because, of course, if it is in English and that is not your native language, it is always a bit more difficult. But, of course, if it's in Korean, if it was translated into that language, you always have to be careful that you're translating apples for apples. But let's see what I can find out while we're still talking here.
Yeah, and I know that maintenance manuals are almost universally in English, for the reasons that you might suspect. And as David mentions, English is the language of aviation in almost every place. There are a few places that are sort of nationalistic enough that they insist on the local language. But generally, these things are in English.
Yeah, my guess is that they were in English, too. But be that as it may, I think an interesting comment came from member Robert Sumwalt, who said that when he interviewed other 777 operators, he found that there were quite a few people that did not really understand how this auto throttle function worked when they put it into the mode that these guys did. And so, again, while it's certainly going to be easy to say the pilots should have known better or should have been trained better or whatever, there are always extenuating circumstances. Although, and Max T will get this one, which I don't know if you read. Did you read the report at all yet, Max?
Yeah, I've gone through the summary. I haven't read it line by line. I was looking at another comment that Robert had made. And he said, "I personally do not believe this is a case of crew competency, and I think largely because of this lack of understanding you describing." But that hardly jives with the overall conclusion, which was that they mismanaged the initial approach. I mean, doesn't that speak to some lack of competency?
Yeah, it's training. Because there's competency and there's training, right? And I view those as two different things. I mean, you can be competent, but if you're not given the training that you need, then it doesn't matter if you're competent because you're not going to be effective. And Max T, I mean, you train a lot of people in flying, and so I think you're familiar with sort of the issues surrounding training. Any thoughts here? I mean, the NTSB is saying that in part that the manufacturer needs to do a better job of providing training that describes just exactly how this auto autopilot system, the auto throttles work. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think probably just about anything could be improved, and I'm sure there are deficiencies in the training. But you know, you kind of look at the chain of events here. Yes, there was probably some lack of understanding, but it reminds me of what I saw just last night when I was flying with somebody I was giving a kind of a final checkout for before they could fly the Cirrus aircraft. And it was clear he didn't understand how to use the autopilot. But he recognized that it wasn't operating the way that he thought it did, and he was able to come up with a workaround. Here, there was no recognition that it was not working the way they thought it was going to work, even though it would have been obvious to just about any pilot that they were below what would look like a normal visual glide slope. So in my mind, the lack of competency was failure to recognize that things were not operating the way they expected them to. I mean, it's fine to not know exactly how everything operates, but you need to be able to be in the loop and verify whether it's doing what you thought it was going to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the safety recommendations or one of the safety issues that the NTSB found was that Asiana pilots need more manual flight. They need to rely less. And we've heard this from a number of different quarters in the industry. Most people seem to offer that same advice, that there's too much reliance on automation and more hand flying is required.
Yeah, a 777 pilot I spoke to said that basically you could fly manually on takeoff for 30 seconds, and then that would be it for the entire flight. The plane would land itself. So, yeah, if pilots fall into doing that, then sure, they are going to lack manual skills.
Well, and the other issue I think that we're facing when we talk about the need for more hand-flying skills is that we're not really sure which hand-flying skills we need to give pilots. Should we give them more climbs and descents? Should we give them steep turns? Should we give them slow flight? Should we make them fly more instrument approaches by hand?
Aeroline rolls and lumshavox.
Lumshavox, yeah, we could do lumshavox.
Hesitation rolls.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, let's start with visual approaches. I mean, that would be a great place to start, I think.
Well, and we may be just simply talking semantics here when Mr. Sumwalt, who we got to get him on the show one of these days.
I think he's a great guy. This is probably the only statement I've ever seen from him that I kind of don't quite understand.
Well, when I was watching this and I heard that and I went, okay. But again, maybe it is how you define competence in the sense that did these people have a valid pilot certificate? Was their medical current? Had they passed their last ATP check ride and whatever? In that sense, they were competent, but they were not prepared for what they faced. And the thing that I think that got me and all of those of our listeners that are pilots are going to cringe when they hear the statement that, when they got low and they got closer and closer to the water, the pilot flying did not touch the throttles. He just brought the nose up. Yeah. And anybody that flies knows there's a limit to how far you can bring the nose up before the airplane stops flying. And it was incredible because you could see the Vazis very clearly out the window, at least through the recreation they did. And you just have to ask yourself, if they didn't see the airspeed slowing and they didn't notice that the nose was up really high, and they didn't notice that they were really close to the water, and they didn't notice that the Vazis were all red, what were they looking at?
How could you say that there was crew competency? I'm sure they're all great pilots, and I'm sure they do well 99% of the time, but competency, it needs to be a little broader than that. They need to be able to do the things you just mentioned.
That's right.
For us incompetent non-pilot CFIs, what the hell's a VOSI?
Oh, sorry. Visual Approach Slope Indicator. It's a meatball. I don't know what. Yeah, it's a meatball. Yeah, it's a meatball that you'd see on a carrier, but it's a visual system of red and white lights that you can see out of your peripheral vision. Actually, it's not even your peripheral vision. It's straight ahead on final. And if you have two reds, two whites, you're right where you need to be. Four whites means you're really high. Four reds, you're really low. And these guys saw four reds, and they didn't do anything. if they saw them. We still don't see. We don't have the individual testimony of the pilots yet. Whether that'll be in the final report when it's printed, which I believe is due out pretty soon. That remains to be seen. But you know, we still don't know what they said they were doing when they, you know, were supposedly on final air.
You know, a couple other interesting things from the summary report from the NTSB is that two of the passengers who died were thrown from the aircraft. The NTSB says they were not wearing their seatbelts, and I guess a third, it's not certain. They don't think that the passenger was, but they're not certain. So I think that's interesting. It also tells you something about wearing seatbelts. And then there were a couple of other interesting things that kind of came out. I think it's an example of the NTSB acquiring data from the accident that may be useful. For example, the passengers experienced some high lateral forces in the crash. The passengers were pitched forward abruptly and then, I think, to the left. And that caused certain type of injuries with the passengers, and the NTSB is saying, okay, so here's this information. Maybe that can be used to examine that and see if there's something that can be done in the future that might deal with those kinds of high lateral G accidents. I mean, it's not really directly related to the crash itself. It is related to the injuries that were sustained. But in these reports, sometimes the NTSB offers up some areas that maybe others can then take and run with. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think there were a great many back injuries, spine injuries from people. But if you watch the video, because somebody just happened to be video, I think they had their phone out, or maybe it was the airport security, I'm not sure what it was, but they had a close-on video of the airplane when it hit, and you see it touch down, snap off the tail, the left wing catches, and then the whole airplane kind of goes up almost as if it was going to go vertical around the left wing. So the right wing is way up in the air, and the tail's spinning around, and then it kind of drops back down on its belly. So, you know, they were really, really tossed around.
It was violent. There's no question. Yeah. You look at the different motions that they rolled in. I mean, it would be one thing if all the force were in one direction, but it was clear that they were being snapped in multiple directions in sequence, and clearly the body wasn't built for that.
Yeah, and they had some of the, the life raft sorts of things deployed inside the plane as a result of those forces. There's not a problem per se with that, as I read the NTSB report here, the summary report, in that those devices experienced forces well above their design levels.
Yeah.
But again, the NTSB says, so here's some data, here's something that perhaps the manufacturers of those can look at and maybe make some modifications based on that kind of data. So that's a good thing.
Another thing I didn't see in the report, but I do remember from at the time of the accident, this happened really literally in my backyard here, so all of us locally were paying a lot of attention to it, was that in the aftermath, immediately afterwards, apparently the pilot or some pilot in the airplane told everybody in the plane, just stay put, stay where you are. Well, and of course, the plane later caught on fire. Fortunately, everybody was able to get out, but you just got to kind of question, what was he thinking? Why wouldn't you evacuate after all the circumstances we've seen where people have been told to stay put and, you know, they've died as a result of it, whether it's on cruise ships that are sinking or even the Twin Towers in New York. I mean, I think the wake-up call that we've all gotten in the last decade is, hey, when something doesn't look right, get the heck out of there.
Yeah, but leave your luggage.
But leave your luggage, yeah.
You're right.
Because here in Philadelphia, we have nose gear accidents and people spend more time. But Asiana was the same way. There was a lot of people who took their carry-ons down the slide.
Sure. Yeah. Well, they didn't want it to burn up, obviously.
Yeah, well, the flight attendants, they were the ones that got them out. If I believe...
Yes.
I think when I read this, I think one of the flight attendants finally said, you know... I don't know what's going on up at the front, essentially, but open the doors and get everybody out of here. And
I think the flight attendant saw fire and at that point said, okay, yeah, this is now when we evacuate.
And I think that's a key thing for everybody in aviation. When something just doesn't seem right, you know, speak up and take action. Just because someone in authority said something, you know, don't just lie down and take it. You know, raise your hand and yell, hey, we got to do something about this.
Yes. All right. Any other final thoughts? I know we've taken up our entire news segment with this one story, but I think it was important that we do that. And I think we could have gone on for a lot more. We'll put some links in the show notes, airplanegeeks.com/305, to some of the materials. And as I mentioned before, this is very readable stuff. And I highly recommend that you take a look, not only to understand what happened, but it also gives you an understanding of how the NTSB approaches these things, what kinds of recommendations they make. And now we'll wait for a couple of things. We wait for the final report, which I guess will have obviously more detail, but also we wait for what actions are taken based on what the NTSB is recommending. Because as we've said before, the NTSB doesn't have regulatory authority. Can't make these things happen by and large. The FAA needs to get involved and others in order to make changes. So we'll see what happens.
Boy, just, you know, I guess, again, I still question some of the discussions I heard at this NTSB hearing. But I go back, and maybe like Max T does, and you look at some of the things that were happening in the cockpit, and these seem to be some really basic flying concerns that if I were an instructor sitting in the right seat of any kind of an airplane and I watched a pilot do some of this, I'd be really concerned about them. Not just because they were going to smack the airplane, but from a what were you doing there while we were on final kind of what were you thinking about? Where were you looking? And I'd be saying, I'm not going to let this pilot go by himself. I don't know, but what do you think, Max?
Well, and I just kind of wonder if maybe there was a certain amount of political correctness that had to be applied in some of the findings here. When Robert said, I personally do not believe this is a case of crew competency. Well, you and I, and just about every pilot I've ever talked to, believe that the evidence suggests that that's not the case. So, anyway, I'm sure it's complex, and they've done a fairly good job of analyzing it.
For my two cents, it's been an interesting process. I mean, it's hard to believe it's been a year.
Yep.
But following it along, and we're lucky to have Bill English, who was the lead investigator, who is basically a friend of the show, and I think we basically all regard him as a friend. It's been a very interesting process for me as an outsider, not a pilot or an airline geek or something, but to watch the investigation go from start to now the initial report and then the final report. So it's been an interesting year as far as that's concerned.
And the last thought I had on this, which is anytime you're in a cockpit up front with another pilot, I think it's important that people speak up when things are not looking right. I worry that sometimes people are a little too polite when you've got two pilots up front, and they kind of sink to the lowest common denominator. Don't lower your standards just because there's another pilot in the cockpit.
All right. Well, again, we're speaking with Steve Zonka. He's the executive director of CAFI, the Commercial Aviation Alternative Fuels Initiative. And alternative fuels, of course, is something that we've talked about, every now and again on this podcast. It comes up quite a lot. But Steve, can we start off by defining what do we mean when we say alternative fuels?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's good to get a couple of foundational principles down so we don't lose one another in the discussion. But, you know, first of all we're talking about the commercial side of the business. And so we're talking about jet fuel.
Right.
And when we speak of alternative fuels, we're speaking of fuels that are produced basically from non-petroleum sources.
So is that the same thing as when we say biofuel?
It is, yes. Alternative fuels, it's a pretty broad definition. It includes even the creation of kerosene or jet fuel from sources like coal or natural gas. But yes, our focus has been on sustainable or renewable alternative fuels, primarily from biomass feedstocks.
And is it true that what the industry is really looking for is some kind of a drop-in fuel, right? We can call it drop-in fuel, something that is a direct replacement for the jet fuel they're using now?
That's correct. With the breadth of the industry and the value of the equipment that exists within the industry, we felt that there was actually no way to pursue a fuel that was not a drop-in. That being that, you know, when this fuel is mixed with the standard petroleum-based kerosene, that it's identical or nearly identical in properties, it's fully miscible, it doesn't separate, etc. So we have a very general definition that drop-in refers that however we make the fuel and from whatever feedstock sources that we start with, what we wind up with is kerosene molecules.
And does that requirement that it be a drop-in fuel, does that make the task more difficult?
Yeah, it makes the task somewhat more difficult. You know, we constrain the total types, the total spectrum of molecules that actually might get into the fuel. And certainly you could wind up with some cheaper fuels, but those fuels typically don't work within the existing infrastructure and with the existing aircraft and engines.
Steve, I have a question for you. What exactly drove this movement for alternative fuels? Was it availability of fossil fuels? Was it the price of fossil fuels or the need to be less polluting to the atmosphere? Or just tell me a little about
it. Yeah, I think it's actually all of those items. I think most of our work can be related back to the concept of trying to decouple the growth of carbon emissions from aviation, decoupling that growth from the natural growth of the aviation sector in terms of passenger miles or operations. The aviation industry, like other industry, recognizes that we have some social responsibilities. We need to maintain our license to operate and our license to grow. And we have expectations placed upon us from different sectors that suggest we have to continue to improve our environmental footprint in order to do that.
We've seen in the past some efforts by the Europeans, for example, to get into carbon trading schemes and that sort of thing. So I imagine that's an example of some kind of a motivating factor for this.
That's correct. In that case, you had the EU interested in placing a tariff or a tax or a charge on the emissions of carbon, which would raise the price of fuel. And with the price of fuel already being a predominant factor in airline operating costs, the airlines viewed that as a threat with respect to their ability to operate financially. And so that was clearly one motivator. And to go back to the question, yes. So that was the primary motivator, was this decoupling of emissions from growth. But we also have these other issues of supply, surety, price stability, energy security. It's an issue that the armed services are looking at. And as we looked at some of the physical properties of the synthetic fuels that we're creating, I find that there are some other secondary benefits that come along with the fuel in terms of perhaps improved local air quality, in some cases a slight improvement in energy mass density, and some other things that people care about, like creating economic development opportunities around the world.
And you mentioned the military. The military is just as interested in this as the commercial side. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so CAFI, by definition of the name, is the Commercial Aviation Alternative Fuels Initiative. But I can tell you that we're working hand in hand with both the military, the U.S. Air Force, Navy, and Army, as well as the business aviation side of the house, all focused on the same goal of bringing these fuels into the marketplace at a reasonable price point.
Now, I'm imagining a whole sort of supply chain here that begins with some kind of biomass or something and ends up with jet fuel being pumped into an aircraft. And there's a lot of steps along that that supply chain. But if we just look at the very beginning for a second, because I think people sometimes wonder, how difficult is it to actually manufacture this fuel? Is that the hard part of this whole issue, or is that the relatively easy part?
Well, it's not the hardest part from the perspective that, you know, we've got a decade or so of real tangible work on the subject so that we know how to physically create these fuels. We know the science of the conversion processes. So although we have to get past that hurdle of qualifying these processes to actually produce jet, the bigger challenges that still remain are putting this entire feedstock supply chain in place.
And so if it's a drop-in fuel for an aircraft, does that mean that the same facilities can be used, storage and, I don't know, pipelines and trucks and all those things? Or are we looking at a duplication in order to support the alternative fuel?
Yes, it's exactly as you described. Because it is drop-in, because the molecules are essentially identical, don't fall out of suspension, et cetera, there's no reason to sequester this fuel in any fashion. It goes into the existing pipeline system, into the existing, it's basically more than pipelines, the whole existing fuel delivery infrastructure, works in the fuel farms, works on the airplanes, et cetera.
And so I'm assuming that so they could be intermixed, the alternative fuel, the biofuel could be mixed with conventional fuels, and it wouldn't really make any difference from a performance standpoint.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's a little bit different approach than you find today, like in the automobile sector with the challenges of using some of the alcohol blends, and the same thing in the diesel sector, the challenges of using biodiesel. They're not drop-in fuels, and so they create these segregation and other performance issues, and we don't expect to have any of those issues.
Yeah, that seems to be a really important feature of this. Is that something new, this drop-in concept, or has this always been kind of the approach that people wanted to take?
It's been the approach that the aviation industry has wanted to take. And, you know, perhaps on a future segment, we can talk about aircraft other than jets with the GA and 100 low lead scenario. It's not quite that simple. They're not taking a drop-in approach, and it's creating a lot of challenge for them.
Interesting.
But with the drop-in approach, what we basically do is these fuels are qualified under one specification, an ASTM spec, and that spec is fundamentally pulled into the existing fuel spec, D1655. And so when the fuel is certified as being this, you know, alternative fuel, it goes out of the plant, it then becomes 1655, and it basically can be used anywhere in any fashion that the existing fuel infrastructure uses jet fuel.
So ASTM has an important role here in terms of approving the final method or specification?
Yeah, they actually approve a production methodology, and that production methodology has been shown that if the requirements are followed, that the fuel being produced does meet the, you know, all of the requirements of the fuel, both physical properties as well as fit for use properties.
And how close are we to actually having one of those drop-in fuels at this point, Steve?
Actually, there are people flying around the world every day on some of those fuels. Most people don't recognize that one of the first fuels that was qualified was a coal-to-liquid fuel developed by a company called Sasol, operating out of South Africa. And so on any given day, approximately 30 to 40% of the fuel uplifted into every aircraft is actually derived from coal. Hmm. So that fuel has been being produced for quite a while. Now on the renewable side, when I start talking about alternative fuels made from bio feedstocks, that fuel has been produced for a couple of years, but it's not in widespread production yet.
But now, as they fly today, they're using a very small percentage. Are they not mixed in with the fuel? I mean, because we're not at the testing a whole, you know, 757 full of a biofuel on a flight, or are we? I don't know.
Well, there have been flights like that, the limiting factor today is simply fuel availability. So Lufthansa, KLM, Alaska, United, Continental, they've all flown with different blend levels of these renewable fuels in the aircraft. Lufthansa did a pretty dedicated program for several months during the summer 2 years ago to look at the real day-to-day issues of using the fuel in the aircraft and verifying that they didn't see any downstream effects of the fuels. KLM right now is flying, a weekly flight into the Azores, I believe. That's we can verify that later. But, yeah, they're doing a flight. And just 2 weeks ago, we approved a new fuel. So this is our third alternative fuel that's been approved. It's called SIP, which is synthesized isoparaffins, and they're derived from hydroprocessed fermented sugars. There's a mouthful for you. We call them SIPs. And within a couple weeks, Gull Airlines intends to be the first airline to fly on a blend of that fuel from Orlando down to the World Cup games.
Steve, it seems like the petroleum companies might stand to have a lot to lose and therefore might have a vested interest in this. Are they stepping up and becoming major suppliers? Or are they still on the sidelines? How is this going to affect them longer term?
Well, I clearly agree with your premise that they have skin in the game. The good news is that the world's airlines have communicated pretty clearly to the big seven fuel producers that they're interested in having renewable fuels. And I can say with a pretty high level of confidence that they're paying attention. And I've got at least five of the top seven fuel producers, jet fuel producers in the world, are actually involved in the qualification process of certifying new production pathways for the production of synthetic jet.
Do they stand to make as much money as they did with petroleum, or are they going to have skinnier margins with biofuels?
Clearly, at the start, I would expect their margins to be skinny. And I view the introduction of these fuels as no different than a lot of other very advanced technology introductions into the aviation space, whether that's a new aircraft type, new engine types, a wholesale replacement of a group of materials in the airplane, et cetera. We're going to have price challenges to start with, and it's incumbent upon the entire industry to put programs in place to come down the learning curve to get to the point where we can produce the fuels. So today they're clearly cost challenged. In a few years, I don't expect them all to be. You know, if they remain cost challenged, we'll never be successful. So the industry is looking for these fuels at basically petroleum equivalent prices. We're not looking for dramatic reductions in cost of the fuel, but we're looking for price parity.
You know, Steve, this sounds really good to me. I'm wondering, though, are there any challenges here? What are the sort of the big issues that need to be worked or resolved?
Yeah, there's several large issues. We talked briefly about the supply chain, and we've got some production goals on the horizon. But we have to recognize that we're standing up an entirely new industrial sector. I often joke to my team that that's all we're doing is just standing up a new industrial sector. And then, you know, so that goes all the way back from agronomy to end use. And we've got these technologists who are coming to the table and bringing their entrepreneurial spirits and some really wonderful technology in some cases. And they have to get through the commercialization valley of death. After they've proven their technology, they physically have to get funded to get through to production. And that's been a real challenge for some of these companies. And then we've got some other elements like policy that's not necessarily favorable and a few other roadblocks, but we're trying to tackle all those issues.
Maybe just spend a quick minute talking about the role of CAFI in this. What does the organization do?
Sure. So like I described before, CAFI is a public-private partnership. And what that basically means is that we're bringing industry together with governmental agencies all after a common goal. And so there are different programs that are available through different federal agencies, and we try to take advantage of those programs where we can to help us all meet those common goals. So we work regularly with the Department of Energy, and they've got a specific division focused on the development of renewable fuels, working with the USDA, where their specific interest comes basically from the top of the administration on coming up with rural development alternatives and ways to reinvigorate middle America, create jobs for returning veterans and those kinds of things. Department of Commerce is focused on, you know, getting U.S. goods abroad, and it's a whole group of mechanisms there that are in play. FAA is interested in doing everything that's required to meet our international obligations on the aviation front with respect to noise and emissions. So they're working. And so CAFE's role is working on specific work elements to move everybody along while pulling in all of the potential interests that can help us move in that direction. And it's not a trivial challenge.
I imagine. All right, very good. The CAFE website is probably a good resource for people who are looking to learn more. Maybe you can tell our listeners about where they can find the website and any other pointers you might give.
Sure. It's at www.cafe.org. And you actually will find quite a bit of fundamental background information about what we're doing, the specific work teams that we have there, the guidance that we've created. We're basically creating a new language that to go along with our new industrial sector so that we're all talking the same kind of language. So we've created frameworks and guidance documents there to help people come and join us in our efforts.
All right, very good. I want to thank you, Steve Zonka, for spending a few minutes talking about CAFE with us, and that's C-A-A-F-I. The website's caafi.org. Any other important things before we continue on?
No, just stay tuned to what we're doing. Like I said, we qualified a new pathway a couple weeks ago. We expect to see three or four more pathways qualified over the next 18 months or so. And so 2 or 3 years from now, I think what you'll find is any feedstock that anyone is interested in talking about will have a conversion process. And so we'll be using everything from oil seeds to lignocellulose to solid municipal waste to biogas to industrial output gases, you name it. We're going to have a conversion methodology, and hopefully that'll help us ramp up towards meeting some of the industry's goals.
Fantastic. This is very encouraging, Steve, I have to say. I'm glad. I'm feeling better now about our industry and it being environmentally responsive in terms of taking action. Of course, as you mentioned, that's just one of many motivations for proceeding down this path of alternative aviation fuels. But we want to thank you for coming and talking with us on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
I'm glad to do it. Happy to do it. And happy to come back whenever you want me to and give you an update.
All right, and now here's Pete Combs to tell us about the Flight Plan podcast from the National Business Aviation Association.
Hello, airplane geeks. Here's a ringing endorsement from the CEO of one of the nation's biggest companies.
Quite honestly, we've come to the conclusion that this is a great use of corporate resources.
How business aviation helps Valero Energy. That's coming up on this week's edition of NBAA's Flight Plan. You'll find us at nbaa.org.
Thanks, Pete. And now, with his airplane of the week, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. The Airplane Geeks airplane of the week, the Saab 105. First flown on July 1st, 1963, the Saab 105 was built for the Swedish Air Force as a replacement for their de Havilland Vampires. Saab in the late 50s wanted to re-enter the civilian market and begin designing what these days would be called a VLJ, or very light jet. This would be a four-place jet, however, the marketing team couldn't find a market to fit it. The Swedish Air Force was just bringing on their new J-35 Draken. The Vampires weren't sophisticated enough as trainers to support the radical new jet. Sweden's neutrality tends to want them to purchase indigenous hardware, if that's at all possible. The new jet trainers like the Canadair Tudor and Huntington Provost were looked at. Saab entered the 105 as a revamped trainer and liaison aircraft for the Swedish Air Force. The 105 became a high-wing twin-engined aircraft. It has a T-tail similar in appearance to the Canadair Tudor, and the power plant was chosen for the new trainer was a license-built Turbomeca Aubisk low-bypass engines built by Volvo as the RM9. The original prototype experienced major issues with the intakes. Airflow through them and across the wing through the exhaust caused much aerodynamic flutter. So much so, there was a complete redesign in the main fuselage of the jet. A second prototype flew almost a year later on June 17, 1964. Modifications met the standards set forth by the the Swedish Air Force, and an order for 150 aircraft was placed. The only additional requirement was it also needed to act as a ground attack aircraft. The initial batch of SK-60As were completely delivered in 1968, and training immediately began on the aircraft and was a success. The Air Force then began modifications. The first was the 60B, which could have up to 3 hardpoints per wing for ground attack. It also gained a gun sight for the pilot on the seat in the left. And after 1970, 60 of the original 149 aircraft were modified to this standard. The hardpoints could carry machine guns, rockets, and external tanks. Saab then introduced the SK-60C, which was a light strike reconnaissance and forward air control aircraft. The KB-18 panoramic camera, built by Fairchild, was integrated into the nose. A photo flash pod could use one of the pylons, and the remaining 5s acted as standard hardpoints. Saab in the mid-70s looked to create a replacement for the 105. Instead, a structural upgrade was put in place. Completed in 1988, the aircraft were given new wings, upgraded ejection seats, and new corrosion control. This was completed on the existing then 142 airframes. By 1993, the fleet of 115 A, B, and Cs were given another upgrade. The airframe's engines were replaced with Williams-Rolls FJ-44 turbofans. The FJ-44 could generate 1,900 pounds of thrust each. With the new engines came a FADEC, or a fully automatic digital engine control, to provide better fuel efficiency and to increase the life of the engine. All 115 aircraft were redesignated as SK-60Ws. Two other variants were flown, the SK-60D and the SK-60E. They were taken out of service to act as spares for the A, B, and C models in 1993. The 105 was built to be a liaison and communications aircraft. It's like your mother's minivan. It has removable seats and is configurable. 2 Saab ejection seats can be removed and 4 airliner seats can replace them. The airliner seats came in 2 versions. One that were more militarized and could support wearing a parachute. The others more comfortable and did not support wearing a parachute. I've always liked this feature, and if you look behind the cockpit at a photograph of the aircraft, there are 2 little picture windows for the passengers. Eventually, 10 were permanently converted to 4-seat transports, given the designation of XK-10Ds. Another small batch were converted to 4-seaters and given ILS. They were used in converting reserve pilots into commercial pilots. Saab also modified the second prototype into the 105 XT export version. The XT featured the General Electric J85 GE-17B turbojets. With the upgrade in engine came the ability to fire the AIM-9 Sidewinder and even more strengthened wing. In 1968, Austria ordered 40 of what would be the Saab 105O. Austria used them to replace another Saab product, the Tunian. In 2010, the Australian aircraft went through a SLEEP program, or a Service Life Extension program, and they should be continued to fly through 2020. Sweden currently has 35 still active in flying condition, and another 45 are used as spares for the 35. So if you want a very light jet and you like splitter camouflage, I highly recommend the two-place trainer that can carry a family of four, the Saab 105. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Wow. David, those old General Electric J85 engines, did they – were those afterburner engines on this aircraft?
No.
No, right?
They're not burning – they're not – it's a trainer. You don't want to give afterburners to rookie students.
That would be just too much fun. And that's the same engine that they use on the Northrop F5, right?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
The engine designed for a cruise missile that became part of an airplane.
All right. Thanks, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline June 30th, 2014. Well, g'day folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 305. And I'm flying solo this week. No, Grant's not putting up with the wintry weather here. He's down with the dreaded lurgy again, I guess, this week. So I'm sitting here doing it solo. So we'll have to make this one a short one. That should make Max very happy. That means less editing for him. Actually, it makes me happy because it's much less editing for me as well. Now, let's go on to a couple of stories we found here this week on australianaviation.com.au, a fantastic news source that we use quite often here at the Australia Desk. And this one's talking about maintenance. In fact, so many maintenance jobs have been disappearing from Australia here from the airline sector over recent years. And of course, most of that bad news has been coming, unfortunately, for Qantas. But here's a good news story this week. And it's interesting because although it's talking about maintenance jobs coming here to Melbourne, it's actually covering two airlines that actually aren't Australian. One of them is Etihad and the other one is Air New Zealand. And this article here, and I'll put a link in the show notes, talks here about Etihad and Air New Zealand announcing that they're going to be sharing maintenance services here in New Zealand and in Los Angeles. Now, of course, Air New Zealand quite prominent here in Melbourne skies, of course, flying in A320s along with Boeing 777s, and Etihad has their maintenance facility here. They also have one up in Sydney where they perform line maintenance predominantly along with, you know, any other type of repair work that needs to be done at short notice. Of course, this being an end-of-the-world destination, as it's known, very important for some of these carriers that are coming from faraway places like the Middle East that they have maintenance bases out here, and it's good to know that, you know, Australian maintenance staff are picking up work. Air New Zealand are going to be able to from now on make use of this facility here in Melbourne, so that's fantastic. And as part of this agreement, Etihad will also be using Air New Zealand's maintenance facilities over there in Los Angeles to perform similar type of maintenance. So really interesting to see that, you know, when Qantas in particular is pulling maintenance jobs out of here, saying that it's not viable to do it, that other airlines, and particularly airlines that don't even come from this part of the world, are setting up maintenance right here in Melbourne. So a really good news story there. And I'm sure that if Grant were here, that he'd be having lots more to say about that. And now last week, folks, we spoke to Alex Fisher. He's, of course, doing the flight of Solidarity, flying around Australia in a Cessna 172 and raising vital funds for the Royal Flying Doctor Service. Now last week, we spoke to him when he was weep away up in the north of Australia, and now he's down in Perth, right over on the west coast. Alex, how are you?
Good, thank you. Yourself?
I'm very well, mate. Now tell us about your adventure in the week since we spoke to you last. How's the flight been?
Oh, it's been good. Very busy. Couple of very long legs and getting into controlled airspace again. So it's been a very busy couple of days.
Now, of course, many of our American listeners are quite surprised when we tell them that we don't have a lot of radar coverage and a lot of controlled airspace in probably the vast majority of this country, actually. So, yeah, I guess that's quite different, isn't it, flying up around more remote areas of Australia, particularly people, if they remember now, you've had your pilot's license, your private pilot's license now for about 4 weeks.
Yeah, that's correct. And it actually really stumped me at the lack of radar coverage that Australia had, because we only got radar coverage coming into Perth about 15 minutes out from Perth. That's where it started, so. Yeah, you are correct there.
And how many stops have you made along the way?
Since we last talked to you, we've made about 20 stops, I believe, just under that, just under 20 stops, which was a little bit more than we expected, but we had to get a bit more fuel.
Okay, now that's interesting because I know down here in Melbourne, of course, for people who are not familiar with Australia's geography, Alex is talking to us way over on the west coast and I'm way down here on the southeast coast. It's been terrible weather down here in our part of Australia the last week since we spoke to you. So has that been a factor for you up there?
No, we've actually had clear blue skies, no clouds so far. So we've been extremely lucky with the weather, especially the winds. We've had tailwinds so far the whole way.
Okay, so the extra stops, just you know, I guess a bit of a learning experience for you.
Yeah, it's just we'd rather have that safety buffer with the fuel and having, you know, land with an extra hour of fuel than land without that.
No worries. And I guess most of us, I guess, you know, your typical 172, I guess, would have about 4 hours duration, I think, if memory serves.
Yeah, about that, 4 hours, just under 5 hours, yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, now tell us about your fundraising effort for the Royal Flying Doctor Service. How's that been going?
Oh, it's been going great. We did a massive fundraising activity at Darwin. At the night we're in Darwin, we went up along the strip there, went into all the restaurants and stuff, and filled up 3 tins for the RFDF, completely full. So, yeah, the Darwin people, they were very generous.
Well, of course, the Royal Flying Doctor Service is a really, you know, it's really comes into its own in that part of the country, and I guess you'd be getting a good appreciation of that flying around in such remote areas. But I guess you'd find naturally a lot of support for the Royal Flying Doctor Service when you're up in those areas.
Oh, yeah, an absolute amazing support network the RFDS have. It's because, you know, some of those towns we go to, they don't actually have a doctor in the town, so the RFDS have to fly a doctor there for the day. So, a lot of support for the Royal Flying Doctors.
Fantastic. Now, where's the aircraft tonight as we speak? Are you down there at Jandakot?
Yeah, we're at Jandakot Airport. It's parked there.
Okay, and tell us about your flight planning for the rest of the flight. Now, of course, the weather has been a factor, and it looks like it's going to be increasingly so as you make your way towards the East Coast now. How's that looking for you?
Weather's the biggest factor that's now come into our flight planning. It's, you know, looking at not just the weather for next day, but the outlook for the next couple of days to see, you know, can we get to Tasmania with the weather for the next couple of days. So, yeah, it is a huge factor that's now come into our equation.
From what part of Australia will you be making that crossing across Bass Strait? Are you going to sort of head to sort of southern Victoria before you head across Bass Strait?
Yeah, so we actually jump across from mainland Australia to Tasmania from Apollo Bay. So that's our leaving point. And then we touch back across on Australia coming back up the coast at Latrobe Valley.
All right, folks, and if you want to support Alex, we mentioned it last week. We'll mention his website here once again, flightofsolidarity.com.au. And Alex, only 17 years old. Alex, when do you turn 18?
October this year.
Okay, so chances are that you'll still be 17 when you finish this flight, mate. We certainly hope so.
Yeah.
And this is a wonderful thing that you're doing, mate, and great to see a young person getting out and doing this sort of thing and supporting the Royal Flying Doctor Service, always a very worthy cause. So, Alex, we might catch up with you again in another week or so and see how you're going.
Yeah, that'll be great. Thank you so much.
Well, outstanding. And I tell you what, he's going to have it all ahead of him over the next week or so as he makes his way east, talking there about some of the weather reports that he'll be looking at as he's doing his flight planning. I tell you what, this is winter down here, and we're having a very normal winter time for this time of year down here. We've had a few mild ones the last few years, but boy, I tell you what, across the southern parts of Australia, and particularly down in the southeast corner where I live, it's been pretty windy and woolly and awful winter weather. So he's certainly going to have the challenges ahead of him, but he sounds like he's doing a great job, and I'm sure that he'll be very, very cautious as he makes his way across east. If you'd like to find out more about the Royal Flying Doctor Service, we do talk about it from time to time. You can find their website at flyingdoctor.org.au. A very unique service, the Royal Flying Doctor Service, and in fact a vital one for people living in rural and remote areas of this very large country. Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. Gee, this is hard work doing it solo on my own. I hope Grant's back with me next week. Until then, I'm Steve Fisher. Cheers, folks.
Thanks, Steve. It's always great to have an update on Alex and how he's progressing in his flight of solidarity. Now it's time for Peter Johnson across the pond.
Okay, for a long time, people on this side of the pond have been concerned about the amount of regulation, particularly in the UK and its links with EASA across Europe. Well, the Civil Aviation Authority has decided to do something about it after being prompted by the government here under its red tape challenge. They're looking to do some consultation. We mentioned it recently on Extended. It's about getting involved. It's about changing the industry you're part of. They want to demonstrably pass the proportionality test to have better regulation and to manage risk appropriately. Now, they've already started on this by setting up the General Aviation Unit in the CAA. They've looked at risk. They've looked at reducing bureaucracy. They've looked at developing a culture of transparency and openness, but they're not stopping there, and they're looking for participation. They're looking for input from the aviation industry to help them do that. But it's really important. They've done a lot. They still have a lot to do. So if you want to get involved, if you want to have your voice heard, then you need to get over to the Civil Aviation Authority's website. We'll put a link there for you to launch your part of that consultation process. Okay, over to some news about British Airways. They've been an awful lot in the news here recently. And the first item is that they are scrapping their first-class service on transatlantic routes, particularly those served by the 747-400s. The carrier announced last week it will no longer offer first class on flights to Las Vegas, Vancouver and Phoenix beyond October this year. And it looks to wind down the operational life of its quote-unquote outdated 747-400s. I also believe that the route down to Cape Town will also be affected. Are they following the market? Well, we know Lufthansa have already made a move like this, but I think it's part of their fleet rationalisation and cost efficiency process. Bit of a shame. The only time I've ever flown first class on British Airways was to Phoenix, so sad to see that route disappear. Sticking with British Airways, there's a strike on the horizon. We've just seen the French air traffic controllers end a strike here, which will cause major disruption to the European air sector. But British Airways cabin crew are now threatening to strike over salary conditions. And of course, with the summer vacation period approaching, this could be a real challenge for them. 95% of crew were in favour of going on strike, so there's an awful lot of unhappy cabin crew there at the moment. However, positive note for British Airways, and if you live within 20 miles of Heathrow or Gatwick and you're a youngster thinking about going into the industry, you can join their work experience programme. They bring along 300 people from local schools and colleges every year to get involved in this programme. Students will spend time with different departments across BA, including customer services, engineering and IT. So if you're young, you want to get into the industry and live within close call of Heathrow, here's your chance. Finally, one of their partners, American Airlines, has paid nearly £20 million for a pair of takeoff and landing slots at Heathrow Airport. And this underlines the ongoing desirability of London Heathrow to hub international airlines. They've bought these slots from Cyprus Airways, who will cease their services to Heathrow and switch over to Stansted. Interestingly enough, this still highlights the fact that Heathrow is a major driving force in the increased capacity issues in the southeast of England. However, the Mayor of London, for those of you who know him, if not, that's Boris Johnson, says that there's a political fix going on, and that's putting Gatwick in pole position for a new runway. Of course, Heathrow is looking to expand, adding one or two further runways. There is a significant amount of publicity around the UK about this issue, with many of the smaller airfields and airports acting as feeders to the various options that Heathrow, Gatwick, Stansted, the runway in the river and all the other ideas for expansion are currently attracting. Virgin Atlantic Airways, they're expecting their first 787 Dreamliner to arrive very soon, and that's scheduled now to fly on its Boston route from Heathrow. And in fact, all of Virgin's 787-9 Dreamliners will go into service across the Atlantic to the US East Coast destinations. So if you're planning to make a trip to the East Coast from the UK later this year and into next year, likely you could well have a ride on a Dreamliner. And just to wrap up, an interesting article I picked up a week or two ago in the London newspapers called Around the World in 22 Days. Those with a taste for the high life and a cool £35,000 will enjoy this chance to circumnavigate the globe in 22 days on a private jet. Captain's Choice, the world leader in luxury private jet touring, will take guests on a reconfigured 767, complete with champagne, fine wines and dining. In each destination, including Mexico, Brazil, Easter Island, Tahiti, Australia, Cambodia, India and Tanzania, guests will stay in first-class hotels. As I said, just under 35,000 £1,000 for that. If you're interested, go to captainschoice.co.uk, and the flight leaves on March the 4th next year. This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
So the mayor is Boris Johnson. I wonder if Peter's related to the mayor. Probably not, right?
I was going to say I hope so, because that's what you guys kind of got me as a short-term going-away present, right? I mean, you can just spill the beans now.
Would it spoil the surprise?
Well, yeah, that's a good point.
Okay. We want to thank Peter. Peter is he's headed off on some vacation, or maybe holiday, as he might call it, for a few weeks. I think he's going offline. But in any event, we'll be without some Across the Pond segments for a couple of weeks here. And so we'll desperately wait for Peter's return.
How can you go offline? Real people don't ever go offline.
It's so hard to do. But if you can do it, it's like heaven. There's probably no internet in heaven.
Have fun, Peter.
All right, we have one listener mail that we want to share. This is from George. George is in the military, I guess the Army. He wrote this to David, actually. And this is, David, I can't interpret all these CPT, U.S. Army 2, CAV, REGT. What does all that stuff mean?
It means I got a really great email from someone when I really needed it most. He grew up in the local area, knew the airport. His father was a base civil engineer. My father was a base civil engineer. And we have a lot of similar experiences. And he's getting back from Germany after being part of a Stryker unit, which is an infantry vehicle, wheeled vehicle. And I will say it now that if he's ever back home in the Philly area, the beers are on me. Really lovely email. We shared a lot of growing up experiences, very similar. So it was a real joy to read, and I appreciated it immensely.
Well, he mentioned that in listening to the an episode last year that covered the NASA WB-57F, right? And he noted that he'd seen this aircraft in Afghanistan, was excited to hear about it. And then he had something about this Battlefield Airborne Communications Node, BACN.
Yeah, we talked about BACN in that. Part of the email was, I couldn't believe that I did that WB-57 story August of last year. It just seems like I did it recently. But interesting timing was, though I won't be there for it, folks, NASA is flying one of the WB-57Fs into Oshkosh this year. So if anybody gets a chance to take some pictures, Rob, I would greatly appreciate it. But yeah, he was talking about the fact that he was a recipient of the BACN node, which is NASA was flying them on behalf of the U.S. military to act as a battle space communications node, which connects satellites to other aircraft, to ground units, to make a unified area. So it was a very cool email to read.
In this WB-57, this is what NASA uses in their high-altitude research program. And this thing flies to some pretty serious altitudes, doesn't it, David?
Yep. So we really should let everyone to go back to, Oh, 70,000 feet. Yeah, it's a high-altitude research. Originally, the Canberra bomber was a strike aircraft. Over time, it grew into a reconnaissance aircraft, and NASA got these large, very large B-57s, and they have, instead of a bomb bay, they have a palletized bay that they can put electronic research equipment into it for high-altitude atmospheric research. So originally, the WB-57s were used to sample the atmosphere for radiological material, otherwise known as... One of our friends, allies, or enemies did a above-ground nuclear test or a below-ground nuclear test. And the way you tell that is because there's radioactive material at altitude that gets taken by the winds. So that's originally what the WB-57s did.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. This has been episode 305. So you can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com/305. And we'll put a number of links in those show notes that I think you'll find interesting, both about the NTSB summary report and also from our guest, Steve Zonko. We want to thank Steve for joining us. He's executive director of the Commercial Aviation Alternative Fuels Initiative. That's CAFI. And you can find them at CAFI.org, CAAFI.org. And we also want to thank our contributors, Steve Vischer and usually Grant McCarron. Hopefully Grant will be back in shape in time for me to forget his name again, maybe, but for next week anyway. Find them at plaincrazydownunder.com. We also want to thank Peter Johnson, as always, for contributing the Across the Pond segment. And you can find his podcast, Aviation Extended, at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell everybody where they can find each of us online. And David Vanderhoof, we will start with you.
I'm DM Vanderhoof on Twitter. I'm on, of course, our Google Facebook page, our Google Facebook page. Oh, it's, you can tell I'm tired. Our Google page, our Google Plus page, our Facebook page. And of course, on Friday mornings with my co-host, Max Flight, on the UAV Digest, where we talk about airplanes Rob don't like because they don't have pilots.
All right. And Rob Mark, where do folks find you?
Well, next week, they're not going to find me here. But yeah, normally it's Jetwine, jetwine.com. I'm sorry, Jetwine on Twitter and jetwine.com. The Aviation Minute, and of course, also at AIN Safety, sometimes in AOPA Pilot in the turbine section. But also, I'll be popping back in now and again just to drive you guys crazy. But I will miss you all for the summer. I hope everybody has a good and fun and safe summer. And Max will remind everyone to put the gear down while I'm not here. And so we'll plan to pop in occasionally, but see everybody else, around Labor Day, I bet.
Okay. Good luck with your projects, Rob. And Max Trescott, tell folks, this is where you can plug, you know, you do a lot of really interesting stuff. So this is your chance. You've got the microphone.
Free advertising.
Oh, great. Well, actually, first I want to thank Rob Mark for writing a book. And Rob, I'm thinking, why don't you do some sequels, you know, for the next year or two?
Uh-huh. I kind of see where this is going.
All right, good. I couldn't resist that. G1000book.com is where folks find some of my glass cockpit books and CDs and things like that. I just noticed moments ago that my maxtrescott.com blog is off the air, so I updated the credit card information, so that should be back momentarily. Turns out those emails were going in the spam folder. And you can also find me on facebook.com as Max Trescott, so feel free to friend me there if you'd like.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter is Max Flight. Also, as David says, at theuavdigest.com and also at runwaygirlnetwork.com for the PAXX podcast that I co-host with Mary Kirby. You can get there direct with the link paxxpodcast.com. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. We're also on Google Plus. And we're on Stitcher.com as well as TuneIn.com. Of course, we have an email address if you want to send us email. That's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Our Aunt Benet has something to say.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
See you next week.